Hello and welcome to Tales from Imperial Russia with Dr. James White.
Episode 27, The Tsar of Thieves, The Tale of Vanka Kain. In 1735, the 14-year-old serving boy, Ivan Osipov, had had enough. He had now been serving in the Moscow household of his merchant master, Pyotr Filatyev, for some 4 years. In Osipov's self-estimation, he had done so zealously, dealing promptly with all the dirty jobs that fell to a prepubescent lackey. But his reward had been only unbearable beatings, probably from both the Filatyev family and the other servants. Osipov was by far the most junior drudge on the estate. Plausibly, he might also have burned with hatred for another slight. He had, after all, been forced into this line of work, wrenched away at the tender age of 10 from his peasant family in the countryside surrounding the city of Rostov. He would not have known that through this callous act, his owner had inadvertently saved him. So harsh were the joint scourges of conscription and famine that the male population on the Filatyev's Rostov lands dropped by more than a quarter in the first 3 decades of the 18th century. And at least as a servant, he got a roof over his head, some food in his belly, and fashionable new European clothes to wear. But these slim benefits were not enough to eclipse in Osipov's heart feelings of indignity, injustice, and a teenage yearning for rebellion. Waiting for his master to fall asleep, Osipov snuck into Filatyev's bedroom to steal money. He then absconded out of the estate, where he met with a waiting accomplice, the young ruffian and thief Pyotr Romanov, aka Pyotr Kamchatka, a 22-year-old former child labourer who at this point had twice been punished for pickpocketing. In an act of defiance and surprising literacy, the two boys daubed a slogan on the palace gates. "Drink water like a goose, eat bread like a pig, but work like the devil, I will not." They then fled into the night. The two marked Osipov's freedom of an act of burglary, stealing clothes from the apartment of a nearby priest. Then Kamchatka led his new accomplice to the underside of the big stone bridge, which, despite being only dozens of meters away from the Kremlin itself, was a renowned hangout of the city's criminal element. Handing over some coin to buy his newly acquired friends some booze, Osipov was inducted into this underworld society as a fellow felon. At this point, he ceased to be Ivan Osipov, serving boy. He became Vanka Kain, soon to be Russia's most famous thief. Over the next 6 years, Kain and his associates were involved in a series of audacious criminal exploits. Letting a chicken loose into Major General Alexei Tatishev's front yard, Kain used the pretense of recapturing it to gain access to the estate, hiding away until nightfall. He then let in a pack of collaborators, pulling off a stunning heist in a crowded and well-guarded household. On another occasion, they made off with both a horse-drawn carriage and elegant women's clothes, so as to disguise one of their female accomplices as a noblewoman, thereby gaining access to the treasures of yet another noble household. Leaving their stomping ground of Moscow, Kain's gang went off to run rings around the merchants at a trade fair near Nizhny Novgorod. Here guards were tricked into arresting an Armenian merchant, leaving the goods and money in a nearby storage barn, conveniently unguarded. In the town of Vyazniki, the band were unsuccessful in getting a local peasant to reveal the location of the governor's palace. When said peasant began drunkenly upbraiding them, K Kane's delinquents tied the man to his cart and set its contents alight, causing the horses to bolt all the way to a nearby village. This was all accompanied by near misses with the law. With Cain arrested and imprisoned on one occasion, Pyotr Kamchatka smuggled a key to his distraught abettor. Getting some Dutch courage from wine bought off a prison guard, Cain snuck off to the outhouse, unlocked his shackles, and fled the jail. What followed was a tense chase, a fist fight, the stealing of a bag of foreign money from a Tatar noble, and a marine escape on the River Volga, wherein Cain and his crew adopted disguises to effect their breakout. Excitement, danger, cunning, and an unerring ability to thumb his nose at the authorities, the rude, and the socially unpopular. All of this earned Cain's exploits enduring popularity among reading audiences when they first encountered them in a 1779 account written by Matvey Komarov, a peasant turned man of letters. For many of the educated public, this was the only chance they would ever have to glimpse into Moscow's criminal demi-monde. So popular was Komarov's work that it went through 16 editions by the end of the 18th century, a runaway smash hit. But how much the book was fact and how much fiction? Setting himself the goal of proving that Russia had an answer to men like France's Louis-Dominique Cartouche and England's Dick Turpin, Komarov drew on a real autobiography, written in 1766, when a much older Cain was serving a life sentence of hard labour and exile in the Baltic provinces. And at least parts of that autobiography are substantiated by the written sources produced as a result of a major twist in Cain's life that occurred after 6 years of criminal abandon. On the 25th of November 1741, a palace revolution occurred in St. Petersburg. Elizabeth, the oldest daughter of Peter the Great, used her connections in the capital's guards regiments to overthrow the infant Ivan VI and his regents. To mark her accession to the throne, in December 1741, Elizabeth offered an amnesty to all criminals and tax frauds across the empire. Vanka Cain, perhaps tired of the endless danger and insecurity inherent to the life of the professional thief, soon presented himself to the Moscow Investigative Chancellery, hoping to buy himself a clean slate with a list of 33 names. The text of his confession survives. "I, forgetting the fear of God and the hour of judgment, fell into no small sin. Being in Moscow and other cities at many times throughout the year, I committed theft day and night. Being in churches and in different places, I took money, handkerchiefs, coin purses, watches, knives, and other items from the pockets of gentlemen, government officials, merchants, and people of all ranks." Cain was then sent with a team of guards and chancellery officials to secure the detention of his former comrades. The result, over 60 arrests, was deemed so impressive that Cain was essentially hired as an official informant, a status confirmed and expanded over the next few years. By 1744, he had been issued not only with immunity from arrest for maintaining criminal connections, but even a regular wage and a small squad of soldiers to assist him with raids. Cain, once the king of crooks, had completely turned coat. As of 1748, it was estimated he was responsible for 774 arrests in 7 years, although the historian Yevgeny Akelev suggests we only have evidence of Cain's involvement in 227 of these. Cain's betrayal seems to have shattered bonds of trust and friendship amidst Moscow's criminal community. Those arrested by him often spewed out lists of names, no doubt put an end to the lashings and beatings administered by police interrogators. From Cain's own interrogation in 1741, and the testimonies of old friends he subsequently arrested, we know that at least some events from Kine's autobiography are true. For instance, several of his accomplices confirmed the reality of the Kine gang's raid on the trade fair in the neighbourhood of Nizhny Novgorod. Other aspects of Kine's life have been fully investigated, confirmed, and corrected by the aforementioned historian Akielev, thereby giving us a reasonably accurate picture of this historical legend. But what is perhaps even more valuable is that the testimonies produced by Kine's spree of arrests give a real glimpse into the daily realities of Moscow crime in the mid-18th century. This was not the Moscow of today, a city of broad boulevards, open public parks, and expansive squares. Such a Moscow was created as a result of centuries of modern urban planning and expansion. No, Kine's Moscow was a dense labyrinth of dark and seemingly muddy alleys, framed by rickety wooden buildings and the decaying remnants of useless medieval walls long overtaken by the city sprawl. Even Red Square, today a massive belt of open space separating the Kremlin from nearby shopping malls and museums, was in the 18th century full of a packed series of trading rows, stalls selling every kind of good imaginable from as far afield as China and the Americas. Elsewhere, the centre took on the visage of a village city, with the lines of buildings broken up by plots of land for communal or private animal rearing and agriculture. Few streets were paved. Stone buildings were just as rare, limited to the Kremlin complex itself, a handful of churches and government buildings, and the very richest of aristocratic palaces. Regular fires left entire areas desolated and deserted, the damaged shacks and houses waiting years to be repaired, demolished and repopulated. Perhaps the only thing that might be familiar to modern Muscovites was the endless traffic jams, as horse-drawn carts, manned by peasants, jammed themselves down the maze of streets, stuck for hours as they waited to offload the masses of food upon which the city was dependent, their horses relieving themselves freely next to an endless array of cheap tavern, food cubbies, public baths, thriving shops, private domiciles, factories and barracks. Around them rushed, plodded and stomped the roughly 140,000 strong population, made up of a dozen nations and ethnic groups. German, Tatar, French and Armenian might have been heard almost as regularly as Russian. Traders, farmers, servants, soldiers, sailors, diplomats, officials and clergy jostled alongside one another. And among them stalked the criminals. Pickpockets, burglars, robbers, fences, forgers and fugitives. The evidence of Kine and his colleagues tells us much about their precarious daily lives. Most had no fixed abode, shifting from one semi-hidden place to the next. They were most often to be found lurking under bridges, in the alcoves of the crumbling medieval walls, in squats abandoned after fires, in safe houses run by those willing to risk arrest themselves for taking in those without proper passports. The frigid winter months were often spent in or near the numerous banya, steam baths, that offered rest and cleanliness to all ranks of the urban populace. The baths were not just shelters, though. Since people disrobed and put down their guard as they eased into the dense heat of the steam, prime pickings, like silk linens and coin purses, were an offer to the quick and limber thief. The trading rows on Red Square, full to the brim with bickering merchants and clients, were another favourite place of business for the able pickpocket, full of people too distracted and too crushed in to pay much attention to the money bags hanging from their belts. churches, monasteries, and cathedrals, especially during major Christian holidays like Easter, were sufficiently jam-packed to offer easy prey to the impious robber. The traffic gridlock too was an excellent location for a spot of thievery, the carters and passers-by being wedged into place, unable to give much chase. And although most of Moscow's criminal element seemed to have preferred working in the city itself, they could, on occasion, turn to highway robbery on the roads leading to the city, competing with the banditry threatened by groups of deserting soldiers and serfs. Criminals rarely plied their trade alone. Most worked together in gangs of between 2 and 10 people, some specialising in distraction, some in the act of pickpocketing, some in breaking and entering, some in making a quick getaway. Here we find a whole host of miscreants who had long since ditched their civilian names for semi-accurate, semi-hubris sobriquets. Among their number we find, for instance, Kondraty the Handless, Sevyeli the Bad, Ivan the Naked, Ivan the Goose, Ivan the Ginger, Matvey the Gypsy, Ivan the Mouth, Dmitry the Cockroach, and Pyotr the Wolf. Cain's own nickname refers to the biblical Cain, the son of Adam, who slew his brother Abel. While the language used among them was yet to evolve into modern Russia's infamous prison patois, there is evidence that a kind of semi-professional gang slang existed, so that information could be communicated between those in the know while keeping out prying ears. Together, they pulled a range of established cons, all designed to trick, distract, and disarm potential marks, with the dishonestly appropriated goods shared out afterwards, usually according to prior arrangement. Razors were excellent implements for cutting purses from belts, as were knives and daggers. These implements could occasionally be put to even more sinister use, as these lawbreakers were certainly not above violence, beating up and even killing victims and guards when things did not go their way. Ivan Metler, a close friend of Cain's, was finally caught and exiled in January 1745 after throwing a knife at his wife and killing her. Her offence was to have refused to bring her husband a bowl of cabbage soup. If marriage was no protection from violence, then neither was rank. On the 13th of February 1749, Stepan Karpovich, the future valet of Emperor Peter III, was beaten to a pulp by a gang of Moscow thugs in broad daylight as they tried to steal his cloak and coin purse. No one nearby bothered to respond to the man's cries for help. Behind this cabal of criminals stood a shadowy network of supporters and enablers. Fences were needed to sell off stolen goods. Forgers provided fake passports. Some landlords looked the other way to fugitives on the run. Prostitutes were comforters, accomplices, and potentially even prospective wives. Guards, servants, and officials might be open to bribes to ignore or help the criminals. Indeed, guards were so poorly paid that there are multiple known instances of them participating in crimes rather than stopping them or apprehending the criminals. Meanwhile, the guard boxes that offered soldiers some protection from the elements while on duty might also be used by delinquents. In the summer of 1745, one young guardsman rented his box out to a prostitute and pickpocket so she could have sex with a client there. But just who were the denizens of the criminal underworld? Here, traditional culprits, like beggars and down-and-out townsmen, meet with the modern victims of Peter the Great's reforms. To feed his vast war machine with sufficient cannon fodder, Peter obliged large swathes of the male population to serve in the army for no less than 25 years, which, given life expectancy at the time, was essentially a life sentence. Many soldiers and sailors chose to flee, either trying to settle far away from the centres of power or forming roving bandit gangs in the countryside. Others fled into the urban darkness of places like Moscow, where there were many places to hide. Criminality was often the only way they could feed themselves. Ivan Gladyshev, a pickpocket arrested in the 1740s, had once been a soldier, a batman to a lieutenant. However, when the officer had beaten his horse to death in a drunken stupor, he had proceeded to blame Gladyshev and ordered severe punishment. Gladyshev thus deserted to Moscow's criminal underworld to save his own skin. Almost as badly off were the dependents of soldiers, their wives and children. The state provided them with little or no support, even in the event that their husbands and fathers died while on active duty, nor were their former commanders obliged to help. Faced with the options of either following the army or living a penurious existence in cities, many chose the latter, and consequently fell into crime as they sought to eke out a living. Soldiers' orphans, bereft of any paternal guidance, could just as easily slip into thievery, especially in Moscow, where they were confronted with the awful conditions at one of the very few orphanages run for their benefit. Caught by Kane in 1742 on Red Square, the teenager Sergei Zortov was just such a boy, an orphan raised in the squalid and overcrowded Moscow garrison school before fleeing in the hope that crime might offer a brighter future. Another major group in the world of the lawless were fugitive peasant serfs. By the end of the 17th century, serfdom had emerged as a nearly inescapable condition for a huge proportion of the rural population. Essentially the property of noble landowners, the state, the church, and even some merchants, serfs could be subjected to innumerable harsh conditions and punishments by their owners. As freedom was difficult to achieve, for most the only way out of this form of slavery was flight, and some chose the shadowy corners of Moscow as their refuge. Their lack of proper documentation meant that there was little way for them to earn their living legally. 18th century Moscow had also become the home to a large number of factories, especially in the cotton industry. But pay was low, conditions appalling, and escape forbidden, once again making crime and a criminal lifestyle attractive to some, especially teenage labourers. Indeed, it is not surprising to find that most criminals, Kane's acquaintance, tended to be young, although there were some more experienced hands among them. Here we have the example of Ivan Serkov, otherwise known as Ivan the Burnt. The son of a Kremlin icon painter, Serkov started thieving only in his late 40s, and already owned his own home by this point. What drove him to pickpocketing is unclear, but thanks to Kane, he was arrested, tortured, and sentenced to death in 1746. Finally, while men and boys seem to have predominated among Moscow's lawbreakers, women and girls were absolutely to be found among them. Vanka Kane's own wife, Marta, was someone he arrested in 1742. She seems to have forgiven him the numerous lashes inflicted on her during her interrogation. Another woman by the name of Akulina Larionova described the activities of an all-female gang of pickpockets and robbers following her arrest in late December 1741. These women specialised in stealing clothes from outside the steam baths. Encounters with the law were an obligatory part of the criminal lifestyle. Most often, this took the form of dodging or bribing the tiny network of guards posted around the city, who themselves might participate in crime. However, when a big catch was available, entire squadrons of soldiers might be dispatched to grab as many criminals as possible, leading to pitched battles in the streets of Moscow. On the 2nd of January 1742, soldiers managed to catch one member of a gang of six holed up in a mill. The imprisoned man was then escorted to police HQ by four soldiers. However, 13 criminals attacked the convoy to liberate their associate. Daring rescue attempts notwithstanding, most captured criminals could look forward to interrogation at the Moscow Investigative Chancellery, a small office headed by a handful of noble judges and poorly paid clerks. Torture was an essential part of their process. Once an initial statement had been wheedled out of a suspect, they could be subjected to whipping up to 3 times to see if their testimony changed or additional information was added. This took place in the officer's torture chamber, an earthen underground structure, the walls of which were ostentatiously covered in the implements of torture. After these interrogations, what was left of the criminals was then escorted to on-site jails, with hundreds of people crammed into several narrow wooden shacks. The Moscow Chancellery was repeatedly so overcrowded that detainees were sometimes housed in the clerk's office. Chancellery was under no obligation to feed its prisoners. While alms and donations were often gifted by relatives and the pious, the prison also regularly gave prisoners leave to beg at nearby city gates, sometimes under guard, sometimes not. In any case, it was regularly reported that prisoners used, voluntarily or involuntarily, the money they gathered to treat their jailers to a few shots of vodka. Unsurprisingly, this made escape relatively easy, such as for the purveyor of stolen goods, Gerasim Yemelyanov, who in 1743 jumped into the prison cesspit and swam to freedom. Indeed, the investigative chancellery itself was located right in the heart of Moscow, meaning that escapees found it easy to quickly slip back into the shadows whence they came. By the 1740s, some senior figures were pointing out that the screams produced during the endless beatings and whippings were so loud that they might be disturbing foreign diplomats walking in nearby streets, who thus might be inclined to report negatively on Moscow to their home states. The centrality of the prison also made it easy for family members to help their beleaguered relatives. Here we relate the utterly tragic tale of Katalina Volodymyrova, a merchant's daughter from what is today Latvia. At the age of 17 or 18, Katerina had been sent to work as a servant for one of Empress Anna's ladies-in-waiting. Presumably as a favour to her young charge, the lady-in-waiting had married Katerina off to Mikhail Filimonov, a soldier in an elite Imperial Guard regiment. However, Filimonov was convicted of a crime for which his nostrils were slit, and he was sentenced to life in Siberia. Nonetheless, he managed to escape and come back for Katerina, with the couple spending the next few years hiding in St. Petersburg and Moscow. When Filimonov was recaptured and brought into the investigative chancellery's prison, Katerina dutifully followed, renting accommodation nearby so she could bring her husband food, money and clothes every day. She finally managed to get herself arrested and tortured for passing her spouse a skein of wine, clumsily disguised in a scarf. She was quickly released, but remained in constant touch with her husband, so much so that she actually fell pregnant. Sometimes after weeks, sometimes after months, occasionally after years, sentences would be pronounced on the luckless inhabitants of a chancellor's jail. The lucky ones were turfed out to their last legal place of residence, occupation or owner, after once more being beaten with the knout, a whip designed to tear out chunks of flesh with knots in its tails. The truly unfortunate were branded, their nostrils slit, and then they were marched or transported over hundreds of kilometres to prison camps in the Empire's frontier. Throughout the 1740s, Vanka Kain sat on the border of two worlds, the criminal and the legal. Thanks to his salary, bribery, and the unlawful requisition of stolen goods, he and his wife started to live at large, renting out a relatively sizable house, hosting regular parties and wearing expensive foreign fashions. As emerged later, the bribes he had been giving to other officials were also luxurious, including wine from the Rhineland, sugar from the Canary Islands, fur gloves and hats, and Italian scarves. It was a necessary condition of his government work for Caine to keep in touch with criminals from his past. Only they could provide him with the information he required to make his arrests. However, it soon became clear that Caine himself had not really abandoned his criminal ways, and was in fact using the government's protection to perpetuate atrocities far worse than mere pickpocketing. In 1747, Caine was himself arrested for having kidnapped the sons of a wealthy merchant in order to extort money from the father. On this occasion, his friends in the investigative chancellery worked to get him off. But they could not shield either Caine or themselves in 1749. This time, Caine abducted and raped Agrafena Tarasova, the daughter of an officer. Her father immediately complained to one of Caine's former victims, Major General Alexei Tatishev. Tatishev sent a squad of soldiers to arrest Caine as he returned along the road to Moscow after the kidnapping. Caught by surprise and then intimidated by the personal interrogation conducted by Tatishev, Caine not only spilled the beans on most of his past sins, but also indicted members of the Moscow Investigative Chancellery for taking bribes. Tatishev recommended the firing of most of the bureaucrats in the Chancellery, and the formation of a special commission to report on how far Caine's tentacles of corruption had spread. After 6 years of imprisonment, Caine was subjected to his sentence. His nostrils were slit, and he was branded on his cheeks and forehead with the Cyrillic letters V-O-R, making the Russian word vor, thief. He was then dispatched for a life of hard labour in the notorious Baltic labour camp near the town of Paldiski. This is where he recorded his autobiography a decade later, by all accounts utterly unrepentant for all he had done. This is our last trace of the man. It is unknown where and when he died. Thanks to Matvey Komarov's enormously well-received epic, the tale of Vanka Caine has gone down in Russian legend. For some, he heralds the beginning of organized crime in Russia, a tale that ends with the modern Russian mafia. For others, he has been diagnosed as the ultimate symptom of the sickness of 18th century Russia, a society where there was no real difference between criminals and the law-abiding, between lawbreakers, judges, and policemen. Perhaps more conservatively, we should look at why he was hired and protected by the state in the first place. Despite all the ideological claims about the absolute power of the Tsar and his law, in reality, the Moscow city government was so powerless to do anything about day-to-day crime that it found itself forced to rely on a deeply suspicious figure like Caine to bring anything like a semblance of law and order to the city. But in this, Russia was little different from any other pre-modern European country before the emergence of professional police forces. What does seem to be different is the criminal world revealed by Caine and his arrested friends. This was a world heavily shaped by the truly transformative social changes unleashed by the reforms of Peter the Great, which created new groups of socially and economically vulnerable people for whom crime was often the only option other than slow decay through hunger and illness. In other words, the story of Vanka Caine gives direct access to the daily world of 18th century Russia, one undergoing immense upheaval, creating many more victims than winners. But this, dear friends, is a tale for another time.